40 years when there was virtually no support for fundamental research. And I'm now here thanks to the generosity of Perimeter, and I'm getting very generous funding from FQX, so it's very nice that Anthony is here, and I can thank them. And in his absence, I would like to thank Rob Speckens for, he's my host on this visit here. Oh, he's present! I see him all.
Another Wikipedia.
Wikipedia error. And I decided to change my talk to some extent. The title of my talk was The Case for Geometry. And basically I was going to come and make the case for continuum geometry and say that I thought that, at least locally, the most fundamental fact was Pythagoras' theorem, which should hold locally, all the way down. I'm still going to make that case, but I decided to change in the light of particularly comments that came on the first day, issues about the uniqueness of the universe, because I think actually the really significant lesson about the uniqueness of the universe wasn't picked up, and I'd like to bring that out. And the other one was a certain reaction to the presentation of Lee and Roberto. I think, despite discussions with Roberto last night, I'm still an unreconstructed Platonist. I just want to say one or two things about that. There's this diagram, which I'll later explain to you what its significance is, but it's the one I promised on the first day. Just to sort of confirm that things are right, I was doing the sort of things that Pythagoras was doing 2.5 millennia ago. I had to draw a circle. I had to get 24 of these things on the circle, and they had to be spaced. I decided to space them with the length of the chalk, and then I had to do the little calculation, and I didn't quite get it right the first time, but anyway, there you are, numbers and geometry, basic things that Pythagoras knew about. I think both, I'm all in favor of the historical way of looking at the discoveries and the development of mathematics and of natural science and of understanding of history and everything. Let me read, this is a rather nice book, 100 years old. For some reason, there's two authors, Florian Cajori and Florian Cajori, PhD. You can get it from Amazon printed on the day before. I think it's fun to say.
Before and after PhD.
That's a good explanation. Yes, there is a this is the revised edition. There's a lovely quotation here from 1883 from Arthur Cayley, the great mathematician, his inaugural address before the British Association. It is difficult to give an idea of the vast extent of modern mathematics. This word extent is not the right one. I mean extent crowded with beautiful detail, not an extent of mere uniformity such as an objectless plane, but of a tract of beautiful country seen at first in the distance, but which will bear to be rambled through and studied in every detail of hillside and valley, stream, rock, wood, and flower. They don't do things like that in modern scientific conferences, do they? And now Cajori adds his own words. It is pleasant to the mathematician to think that in his, as in no other science, the achievements of every age remain possessions forever. New discoveries seldom disprove older tenets. Seldom is anything lost or wasted. Now, Lee and Roberto are very worried about time, and Dutch TV made a lovely film about my ideas that time doesn't exist called Killing Time, and it was shown for the first time about 11 years ago in Holland. And the morning after it was shown, the producer was waiting for a delayed train on Amsterdam Central Station, getting more and more impatient. After a bit, a man came up to him and said, "Calm down, relax. Didn't you see that film on television last night?" Now, this is my advice to Lee and Roberta. Whether there's time or not, it's a damn beautiful world we're in, and a very interesting one, so just calm down and relax. Anyway. So now, let me just say, those people who think that the underlying reality of the world is discrete, and that they invoke Riemann for that, I think they're just throwing out too much structure. My doubts about recovering space-like structures from graphs and things like that, I find they're just too... It's too difficult. It's what you call the inverse problem, Lee. And therefore, I think it's too soon to throw away the continuum, one of the really great achievements of mathematics. And, of course, in loop quantum gravity, Roger Penrose's spin networks play a crucial role. If you look at Roger's very first paper, he very confidently says that the world should be discrete. I think he says it should be discrete. He certainly says it should be combinatorial, and the laws of nature should just follow from combinatorial things. And a year or so ago, I asked him about that, and I said, do you still hold to that view, Roger? And he said, well, in the meanwhile, I've become rather impressed by the power of complex analysis. So I'll just leave you to contemplate that. Now, what I decided to bring in, which wasn't in my original plan for the talk, is what I think is actually, for me, the deepest of all philosophical statements, conjectures, if you like, which is Leibniz's definition of a thing. Leibniz says that any contingent thing has infinitely many attributes. All the things in the universe are distinct. They have all different attributes, and yet in a miraculous way, they're all different views of the universe from different points of view. And for me, this is just a fantastic idea. And I want to explore the implications of that. This is very intimately related to questions of epistemology, structure, all sorts of things immediately sort of come out of that. Let me first of all read another quote, though. This is from another great mathematician, Horace Lamb, 1902. This is a shorter one, page 26. Here we are. If any one scientific invention can claim preeminence over all others, I should be inclined myself to erect a monument to the unknown inventor of the mathematical point as the supreme type of that process of abstraction which has been a necessary condition of scientific work from the very beginning. In Leibniz's view, which I should like to support, that's the most pernicious concept that has ever come into science. According to Leibniz, if there is no variety, there is nothing. If you could see no variety, there is nothing. Nothing will come of nothing. And Leibniz, I think somewhere, I've managed to relocate it, he talks about reality as being positive variety. And this book is very interesting, how late people came to accept negative numbers. In a way, I don't think there are really negative numbers out in the world. It's all positive wherever you look, blue, red, green, and things like that. Now let me go on to Leibniz. So Leibniz, in his attack on Newton's idea of absolute space, denies the existence of absolute space because all the points, this beautiful mathematical point that Lamb loved so much, they're all identical. It's a fiction. In reality, to make it any meaning, you have to think of space as lots of little tiny grains of sand closely packed together. And then the idea is they're all identical, except there's just enough to tell them apart if you had to look at them with a microscope. It's a complete and utter fiction. So let me just read from Leibniz's Monadology, 1714. This connection or adaptation of all created things with each and of each with all the rest means that each simple substance, that means each thing, us, we're a monad, we're one of these things, has relations which express all the others, and that consequently it is a perpetual living mirror of the universe. And just as the same town, when looked at from different sides, appears quite distinct and is, as it were, multiplied in perspective, so also it happens that because of the infinite number of simple substances, don't be confused by that simple, they're infinitely complex, but they're held together. By simple, he means you can't split them apart. And that's what the simple is in German medicine. It's a simple come, I think, from one single plant rather than a mixture of plants, isn't it, I think? Of a single it is as if there were many different perspectives of a single universe in accordance with the different points of view of each monad. And this means of obtaining as much variety as possible, but with the greatest possible order, that is to say, it is the means of obtaining as much perfection as possible. And I promised to show you perfection today, and here it is, the thing I managed to construct. That is based on Lee's idea for putting mathematics into Leibniz's idea. Lee, I think I will give him credit for being the first person to come up with a mathematical implementation of Leibniz's idea. But we're finite beings, so we couldn't make it infinitely large. So this is one where there's 24 monads in the universe. And they're all different. And they're more different in any other... They're more distinct and individual than any other way you could do it. Let me explain how this is created. I've specified that there are 24 slots, and I have an undetermined number of balls of two different colors. And my task is to place the balls in the slots in such a way that if we're trying to identify a ball, I can't say to you, I mean that one there. I can say things like, the slot I'm thinking of has got on either side of it two of the opposite color. And the rules of the game are that, first of all, I can't say left or right, and I can't say which color. So it's left-right, it's perfectly left-right symmetric. I don't specify how many balls go into it, that's got to be determined by the solution. And the criterion for selecting my most varied one is that I compare all pairs, and I say, how far do I have to go from this one, giving that label-independent way of identifying? How far do I have to go from that one to identify it from this one? Well, that's very easy, because I only have to go one step. So that's because that's got opposite ones on either side, and this has got identical ones on the same side. So the indifference of these two things, that's the indifference, the lack of variety, is one. So I write down an indifference of ij is equal to whatever it is for that one, one. And for all pairs, I work that out, and then I get the total indifference, I less than j, is the sum of those ones there, and that's my I, and then the variety is 1 over I. And I generated this on a computer, and it is the unique one that gives the maximal variety. Sometimes you get two or three that have the maximal variety for different numbers. But I would assert that within the framework of the problem defined in this way, that distribution of the balls is more perfect than any other that you could have. And I think if you'd looked at it for a few days, you might have admired it as a Mondrian painting, as I said. But you might have actually worked out what it is. So I think it's very intriguing. And let me also say something from my own life. Many, many years ago, I had a very deep psychological experience. I was sitting in the garden on a beautiful sunny day in September. And I suddenly had the very deep feeling that I was absolutely nothing. All I was a point, and all I was the whole universe as I see it from out there. This was 3 or 4 years before I read Leibniz. And this morning it suddenly occurred to me I was wrong. Because suppose this is me, all I can see is all that lot out there. But if I manage to work out why they look like they are, I can say, this is a maximal variety distribution. I'm blue. Which is quite an intriguing thought, I think. David?
Should I be thinking in terms of information coding theory? This maximal variety looks a lot like prefix-free codes and coding trees and things like that.
This is one of the things I've never yet got around to following up. My son Boris, who's persuaded me to go back to this and try and chivvy Lee and myself into getting something done on this, is saying we really should do more about this. I think there are all sorts of implications from this which are very interesting. I think this has something to say very much about the search for a definition of information. I think it's also very much the real enemy, Roberto, is not time but reductionism. This is totally and utterly against reductionism. It's totally holistic, this thing here. You can only understand the whole picture holistically. I think this, there's a lot of things that John Wheeler said that I agree with, but I think he got one thing totally wrong, his idea that you could derive it from bit. I think the idea that there are bits of information floating around there is just completely and utterly wrong. And I give this as a counterexample. There is absolutely no way in which you can take that and say, ah, that's a bit of information. It depends upon the entire context. There is no way there. So I think that's the first thing I would like to say. I think the idea of that there's a local definition of information is just wrong. It's a global thing, and we can never get it perfect because of precisely, we're coming back again and again to Marcello's diagram. As we go on out and out, it's this ever-enriching of the thing, it's ever-enriching of the data and of the mathematics and so forth there. And we'll always get an effective thing. But what happened, it's the other way around. From it, you can get an approximate bit. In this context, we can talk about bits. But it's the wrong, John Wheeler got it the wrong way around, I believe.
Is it essential that the topology is compact? I mean, does this work on an object as a... You have an infinite number of objects, your object,
and you're well, a line, right? Yeah, this is homework or graduate students or PhD students. I mean, there's a great many things that one could explore with this thing, but I think this is the seed idea.
Really, I mean, originally we did it on a line. So we did originally formulate this on a line. So the answer is yes.
Yeah. Well, and you also did it. You also did graphs, didn't you? You did it
with
graphs.
We did planes, also distributions.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Let me go on now. So now I want to consider Newton's first law, the implications for Newton's first law. So Newton said that a particle left to itself will travel in a straight line at uniform speed unless something else hits it. And Leibniz, of course, didn't like that. And there's all sorts of things that are questionable about this thing. So I'm just going to list them. And I'm told that the orange chalk may not come out so well. These are important points. We need to define... position. Length. We need to know what do you mean by an instant of time? We need to know what's the definition of duration. And looking ahead, we need to have a definition of simultaneity. And that just absolutely cannot come out of Newton's absolute space and time. It's got to come from the rest of the world to make any sense of the law of inertia. So let me make a start on that. The minimum you need to do non-trivial dynamics is three particles, and you can do virtually everything you need with three particles. So first of all, I'm going to define an instant of time. An instant of time is a configuration of three particles. So my universe is going to be a three-body system, three particles, and each instant of time is a possible configuration of those particles. So my time is not a line, an unstructured line of these pernicious, featureless points. It's a complete space, and it's got a very interesting structure, which I'll come back to. It's highly asymmetrical. This is a figurative, a schematic representation of the space of shapes of triangles. And let's, for simplicity, let them all have equal masses. So it's three equal mass triangles. So we start here with the equilateral triangle. And out here we have the other triangles. And this is an asymmetrical space. It has frontiers. There are special paces in that space where all the three particles are on a line. They're collinear. There are special, highly distinguished and dangerous places where two particles are sitting on top of each other. And there's the equilateral triangle. And this very, very, very significantly is the most uniform structure you can have. So all shape spaces have a point alpha. This is point alpha, which is the most uniform shape that you can have in that thing. So these here, these are all the instants of time in here. And they can be infinitely rich. In field theory, they are totally, each one of these is truly infinitely rich. But and it's highly asymmetrical. So that's it there. So there is absolutely no sense in which time is linear. So again, relax, don't worry about that nasty old time and things like that. This is a different world in which we're living. And I'll conjecture that if there is a notion of the Big Bang, that's the Big Bang, and we're somewhere out here. The Big Bang is not in the past, it's somewhere else in the configuration space. So now I'm just going to... So position... Oh, well, that's fine. So position is defined by the particles. That's all we've got. The particle... Niaj?
I don't understand. So you're saying Big Bang is not in the past?
No, it's somewhere else in the configuration.
So if you go back in time...
You can't go back in time. There is no time. Forget it.
I see.
We're trapped here.
But if I observe back in time, like...
Well, that's because you've got records, or what you interpret as records.
Yeah.
Time is an inference, the past is an inference from the present based on what we interpret as records. We interpret the structures we find around us to deduce the past. Oh, that we'll recover that. We'll do it. First of all, the position. Now we can begin to start getting into Newton's thing. Positions are only defined by the positions of the particles with respect to each other. Now, how can I say a particle has moved in this case here? If I have one triangle and another one that's slightly different, I hold this one fixed here, and I move this one around using the Euclidean generators of translations, rotations, and I can even blow up the triangle without changing its shape. So there's a sevenfold ambiguity in where the particles have moved if you just can't see absolute space. So how do I resolve this thing? Well, it's done by best matching. That's the key principle. I would say this is one of the fundamental principles that is needed in this program. The idea of best matching is those are incongruent triangles. So I'm going to apply the principle of least incongruence. I'm going to move, using the Euclidean generators, I'm going to move the second triangle around relative to the first until I bring them to the best coincidence I can. I'm going to measure it just by the... And that'll generate little dx's where each x has gone. So I'm just going to sum over I. And I could put in the mi's if I like. And then these delta xi's. And I'm going to take the square root of it. And when I find the minimum of that, that is actually the position of the second one relative to the first. And then I've got a well-defined definition of displacement.
Doesn't
the
dxi's, isn't that where absolute space comes into this?
No, there's no absolute space in this. I just put the triangle on one triangle on top of another. I keep generating the
dxi's. How do you measure the difference between a configuration without a spatial metric?
I'm assuming Euclidean space.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Yes, I beg your pardon.
This is just for time.
Yes. I'm not going to throw away space at the end. All I'm going to leave is the celestial sphere. We'll come to that. That's it there. So that's the essential point of it.
Quick clarification question. So the delta xi's, those are the distances when it has found the closest match, and the mi's are masses?
Yeah, okay. That's right. If you then take this as... This then defines a metric on the configuration space. And if you look what are the geodesics of that metric on the configuration space. They are actually the changes in the relative, that Li yields the changes in the relative configurations, the separations, that follow from Newtonian inertial motion. That is the derivation of Newtonian inertial motion from Leibnizian principles. I haven't yet talked about time. If you want to make it give you Newtonian gravity, you just put the Newtonian gravitational potential in there as a conformal factor, and it will give you Newtonian gravity. With vanishing angular momentum, I should add, and one particular value of the energy. In this case, it's going to be energy exactly zero, but you can't, it's not easy to control the energy. That's sort of something a bit unpredictable. So we've got that there. Now we've got on to, so I've done instant, and I've, length is going to come right at the end, actually. I'd rather jump ahead of that, because until we get rid of the length that's implicit in Euclidean geometry, we can't derive length. But we'll derive length from angles right at the end. Now duration, well, essentially, as I said, this is giving me Newtonian motion with vanishing angular momentum and one fixed energy. So there's only one way, as the astronomers discovered 120 years ago, if you've got an n-body system, like the solar system, once they realized that the Earth's rotation was not a reliable clock, the astronomers realized there was just one way in which they could define time sensibly. And this is what they called ephemeris time. And the definition of that is you can base it on energy conservation. I prefer to go at it slightly differently, but to shorten things, I'll just say let's assume energy conservation. But it's really a reflection of the form of this law. There's no E in there, or E is zero in that. You just invert the energy relation. You don't use the energy for the total universe. Now, this is where things for a complete universe become completely different from subsystems of the universe. This is the other thing I wanted to point out. The energy conservation law, it is not an energy conservation law for the universe. It's the definition of time. They swap round very dramatically. So you just say, you invert the normal, your conventional energy relation, and you say that delta T is the square root, I'll do it for inertial motion, the sum over I, delta xi squared. And if you actually have an energy and a potential energy, let's do it more generally, it's E minus V. And at this stage, I've kept an absolute length of scale. That is the increment of time. That is the definition of duration in an island universe, in a closed universe. That is the definition of duration. So we've got that one. And this is very nice, because if you have what looks like two subsystems, now we get subsystems of the universe, we have a big island universe with lots of systems, and then there are two that are, in Newtonian terms, isolated. And you say, can I construct a clock where my two... Now, the criterion of a good clock is that it marches in step. Why do we have watches? So that we can keep appointments. If you have a definition of a clock which doesn't ensure that two independent clocks run simultaneously, I mean in step, you're in trouble. Doesn't matter if one person has it going, the unit is 1 second and 2 seconds, but you're in real trouble as soon as there's a drift of the frequencies. So what's so really beautiful about this expression, and this is where this denominator comes in, is that if your system breaks up into two, and you send off teams of astronomers to determine a time signal from here, the general motion here, time must be derived from some change, your hands of your clock move, there is only one time that they can generate. And that is this ephemeris time within each subsystem. And it's very interesting, because if this system is going down into its potential well, so the particles are moving faster, and this one is rising up so that they're moving slower, you can see the problems of getting clocks that march in step. But the wonderful thing is that if there's a bigger increment here, there's a bigger increment here, which balances out. So it's a miracle of pre-established harmony that these things two go in step. And the other thing which is crucial is that none of this is possible without a dynamical law. You cannot define a notion of duration until you have a dynamical law. And that dynamical law is defined timelessly, and then you get the definition of duration. So that's the step. So that goes there. And these two will come on afterwards. So let's see how I'm getting on. Right, now we'll go on to the stuff that I got an announcement from Niyash in his very nice talk. Thank you, Niyash, and for the plug. Right. So Riemann, who's been mentioned at least once or twice today. When Riemann created Riemannian geometry, he noted, first of all, that to measure something, you have to place one thing on top of each other. So I call that the length I want to measure, and this my measuring rod, and then it's more or less equal. So it's one unit. He makes that observation. And then he makes a rather remarkable assumption that even if my rod and the thing I want to measure are widely separated, it is still meaningful to say they have the same length. So Riemannian geometry makes this very remarkable assumption that lengths, however far away you are from each other, lengths are comparable. And that is reflected in Riemannian geometry, that if you parallel transport a vector around a closed curve in Riemannian geometry, it will in general come back with a different angle, but it always comes back with the same length. There's a rigidity of length. And immediately after Hermann Weyl, independently of Levi Civita and somebody who's Hessenberg, had discovered parallel transport and connections, Weyl said, hang on, Riemann didn't go far enough. He should have made parallel transport under length change. In a Nahwirkungs theory, Weyl was very impressed, like Hilbert, from whom he got it, with the connections between physics and mathematics, and they were, everybody in Göttingen was completely persuaded of the Maxwellian idea of contact interactions and things like that. And so there shouldn't be any rigidity in the laws of nature, and there shouldn't be any rigidity in the laws of geometry, says Weyl. Great idea. Also, epistemologically, which is not so emphasized so much by Weyl, but it is there, well, it is too, is that actually what we only really observe ever is angles. When I open my eye, what I see is angles. And one of the most wonderful examples of this is the whole of naked eye astronomy, from its beginnings in about 150 BC with Hipparchus through to Kepler's discovery of the laws of planetary motion. It was all done with angles. The time, every single observation was an angle, carefully recorded. Ptolemy was using records of eclipses that had been made 800 years before his time. So it's angles. So really the idea that length is out there in the world is a major conjecture that we have to question. And Riemann in his famous 1854 habilitation lecture says the real evidence for Euclidean space on the scale of the solar system is the success of Newtonian dynamics in explaining the observations that we make on the sky. So from the way angles change, we deduce Euclidean geometry out there.
That's a pretty radical claim, and I'm just wondering how much hangs on it. That all we observe is our angles.
I believe that angles are the bedrock of science, and I think if you, an exercise I would like to do is see if one looked at all instruments, if not ultimately at the end of it, every final decision is based on an angle, even if it's reading out the results. I mean, let me just give you the example, though, of one thing you can do. Newton splitting the spectrum and showing the spectrum on the shutters on his window. By the way, just for your interest, spectrum, the word is coined by Newton, and it's Latin for a ghost. And it was because there was distrust of optical instruments, and the Aristotelians didn't want to look through Galileo's telescope because they thought he was doing conjuring tricks and things like that. So Newton splits the spectrum, and the wavelength is shown out there. So Newton looks at it, he sees that, so that the image of the spectrum is onto his eye, and that's where that comparison, which is, it's a ratio of length or an angle. I mean, angles and ratios of lengths, or at least very short lengths, are good enough. But ultimately, if you want to make the length shorter and shorter, at the end you finish up the limit as an angle. Now, so that gets you the wavelength of light. Now, if you want the energy, the intensity that's in the solar spectrum, you see how the heat that's falling on the wood expands the wood. And you see that as an angle, that's a slowly growing thing there.
I see it. I mean, that was my example of color, right? I think I see something there, and it could be red or green. And the angle it subtends in my visual field is the same. But you're giving me a way to interpret that color observation as an observation of an angle? Is that the...
Yeah. I mean, and then from the angles, I think one could say that everything that we know about everything that we believe about the universe is... based on raw data, which are angles, which we trust as the ultimate bedrock of empirical observations, coupled with ever more sophisticated theories.
What about temperature?
Well, I mean, Galileo's thermometer, it relied on expansion, didn't it? And then ultimately he makes a measure, a ratio of lengths, and ultimately that's projected onto his retina when he's reading it. And then it's a mystery what happens after that. Perhaps we shouldn't get into that too much, because I think that's a topic for discussion. But I think it's an interesting thing there. Right, so when should I stop?
You should stop at...
It depends upon how we deal with this. If your discussion is in the middle... You've gone 40 minutes.
40 minutes. I think I can do it in about 10 minutes from here. So that's it there. So now I want to... go to the other two things, which was length and simultaneity, how they can be derived from angles. So I think Weyl analyzed the problem correctly, but I think he made the sort of solution in a too complicated way. Weyl introduced a new connection whereby lengths change under parallel transport. And 10 years ago, my... Irish collaborator Neil O'Murrahu, unpronounceable. I hope he doesn't watch this. Actually, in English, it's just Murphy. And apparently the Celtic etymology is sea dog, a pirate. He's very proud of the fact that he had two uncles who were in the IRA. So every book about the IRA that comes out, he immediately opens it and looks at the index to see whether his uncles are mentioned. He's a really wonderful mathematician, Neil, and what I'm going to talk about today would be completely impossible without what Neil had done. And very crucial in this is we're coming on to Jimmy York's work on the initial value problem in general relativity. Neil was his first student, and there's an absolutely key equation, the Lichnerowicz-York equation, and Neil was the person who proved the uniqueness and existence of this miraculous equation, which is actually going to lead us to a definition of length, a derivation of length and simultaneity. So what Neil and I set out to do was not introduce extra mathematical structure as Weyl had done, but instead just say, use Riemannian geometry, but make sure the length part of it doesn't come into play any physical role. So you're going to ensure that you don't do that. So the way to do that is with this concept that mathematicians called a quotient space. We can talk about that with a triangle. If you specify a triangle with Cartesian coordinates, so there's nine coordinates you specify, but then you apply the Cartesian translations, rotations, and dilatations, and you can move, you start with one triangle, and you can change it into all those other ones with 9 degrees of freedom. It's a colossal thing. And in terms of the Cartesian coordinates, those are all different. So that's the space of Cartesian coordinates. So let's call it C for Descartes. But then you say, I'll quotient it, and that means I look at all the different, I then identify all the ones that are up there, which can be brought to exact congruence by those Euclidean transformations. And so I take the quotient with respect to E, and that gives me shape space. So that's the space of possible triangles, shape space. And that's, for triangles, that's the fundamental space. Now, in Riemannian geometry, I'm going to assume, again, this is just one particular example. Let's just take a closed universe on the simplest manifold, S3, and we're going to work with that. And then there's a, first of all, there is a space, Riem. And Riem is the space of all Riemannian three geometries, Gij of X, defined on that M. And the Riemannian 3 metric, so it's a positive definite metric, the Riemannian 3 metric, it's symmetric and it has 6 components. But everybody knows 3 of those are just coordinate information, and the other 3 represent the three-dimensional geometry, the Riemannian geometry. So now you quotient with respect to what are called diffeomorphisms. Now, I want to just say something about diffeomorphism invariants, because I think there's a great deal of confusion about it. Everybody says general relativity is four-dimensionally diffeomorphic invariant. This is a true statement, but it's just a statement about changing the coordinates on one four-dimensional structure. So there's one meaning, which is that if you're given one structure, one shape, and you change the coordinates on it, you don't change the thing. And this is what underlies the development of Sophus Lee's work and the theory of Lie groups. It was the idea that if you move things around with what then became known as a continuous Lie group, you're just looking at the same thing from a different perspective. Now, a totally different thing is if you have two objects, each of which are described in this way, and you want to find an objective comparison between the two. That's where best matching comes in. And that's much more fundamental and revealing of what's really going on. So the real issue in general relativity is not about the description of the space-time, it's the description of how the space-time is constructed by comparing different three geometries, and that's the essential feature. So the real real hard point is nothing to do with the description of a single object, it's a comparison of two different objects, which is the important thing, when you're in this situation. So that's Riem. Now if you say that all Riemannian 3 metrics, which really describe the same geometry in different coordinate systems, so you quotient Riem and you get quotient Riem by 3 diffeomorphisms and you get John Wheeler's concept of superspace. So that's Riem over 3 diffeos. And that's what we got from Riemann. Now, Wheeler already thought you should go further, and he gave the hint to York to work in conformal superspace to attack the problem of the initial value problem in general relativity. You can go one step further, and you can quotient superspace by three-dimensional conformal transformations. Now, a three geometry, I call them three conformals, a three geometry has 3 degrees of each space point. 2 of them describe the shape of space locally. So if I imagine I've got coordinates on my manifold, and I, in coordinate space, I plot a sphere, and then I use the metric to measure how far it is from the center, the coordinate center of the sphere to its circumference, and measure out using the metric what I get, I find that I've got a triaxial ellipsoid. And those lengths out to the circle have dimensions. So to get something dimensionless, there are 2 ratios of 3 quantities with the dimensions of length. And that describes the local shape of space. Those are the 2 conformal degrees of freedom. And they determine angles. And so that's the more fundamental part, the angles part. And then there's a scale factor, which says how large this ellipsoid is, or triaxial ellipsoid is, when you measure it out. But that's really, in my view, is just as meaningless and just as gauge as the coordinates are. There's nothing that's directly observable that can tell you that there's anything out there. The conjecture that there's something that we call 6 foot of distance between me and Niash is actually our idea. It's based on our long experience, I mean our memories, that I have to walk if I want to get to Niyash. But the fact is the walking, it's the feeling, it's the sensation of walking. It's the difficulty of getting there which tells me it's far away. I don't see the distance, and I can't ever get hold of it. It's just as impossible to tell there's any distance in the world as it is to go back in time. It's utterly impossible. It's a conjecture. And the justification for the conjecture is if we need it to explain phenomena. I come back to what the Greeks said. The Greeks had, for me, the best definition of science. It is saving the appearances, explaining the phenomena. Explicare, unfold, explain so that you can see what's going on and understand what's going on. So if we find we cannot explain the phenomena without postulating length, then okay, in it goes, and we're all right. But if we find we can explain the phenomena without length, get rid of it, away. And I think this is, looks to me, this is early days, but it looks to us, Neil and myself and the people who are working with us, and Niyash has come in on this, and so is Sean Gribb here, and is making valuable contributions to this program. It looks to us if that's possible. Now look, what I'm going to do is just tell you what the answer is. And then perhaps we'll go into details of this. I'm not going to give you any equations at this stage. I'm just going to say, here is conformal superspace. Now, on this, and so this is utterly timeless, and there's no trace of distance in it at all. And on such a, on any manifold, you can define two things. Well, first of all, you've got a point. These points are well defined because there's lots of lovely little shapes there. This is none of this problem of no lack of variety. There's infinite variety in a conformal three geometry, at least in our mathematical representation of it. It's there, all right. So I can specify a point, and then I can think about two things. I can either specify, I can then think of a direction, or I can think of a tangent vector. And I'll distinguish a direction from a tangent vector by putting an arrow on it like that. Now, there's something, I think, extremely subtle and mysterious about the difference between a direction and a tangent vector. What is the difference? A tangent vector has magnitude. A direction is defined by direction cosines, so you sum direction cosines and square them, you get one. So whereas a tangent vector is not constrained. It's unconstrained. And if you ask, what is the origin of the transformation theory in quantum mechanics, Dirac's darling transformation theory, it actually comes in a very interesting way through absolute time. Because if a momentum is a direction with a magnitude, and if it weren't for absolute time, the momentum space in quantum mechanics would have one less dimension than the configuration space. We live in three-dimensional space, but the sky is two-dimensional. It's as simple as that. So the perfect darling transformation theory of Dirac hinges on that fact of there being a tangent vector as opposed to a direction. And what Neil and I have found is that you can do Now, what we now say is I want a theory in conformal superspace, and there are two possibilities. One is that a point and a direction determines a unique curve. That's a geodesic principle. Or a point and a tangent vector determines a unique curve. And in that case, there will be a one-parameter family of solutions which are all tangent to each other at the initial point and then splay out and go in different ways. And there's a well-defined theory, a mathematically well-defined theory, very interesting, which we found 10 or 11 years ago. It doesn't look as if it's got the remotest chance to explain cosmology. If you let in, this requires an independent variable. But what is that independent variable? For Newton, it was time. You have to have an independent variable to have a tangent vector. And if you allow a tangent vector and an independent variable, then there is a theory, and we can go through the details if you want it, which gives, under that specification, gives a unique curve in conformal superspace. Now, what is that? What does that correspond to? Well, now, Niyash has already mentioned conformal constant mean curvature foliations. If you take an Einsteinian space-time, there is a, in general, you can foliate it in any way you like. This is the foliation invariance of general relativity. It's the lack of a definition of simultaneity in general relativity as it was formulated by Einstein. And it's one hell of a problem if you're trying to do quantum gravity. I think Lee would agree with me. It's immensely difficult to cope with the foliation invariance. Now, and there are constraints. You have to, there are two fundamental constraints in general relativity. You can't, it's not like ordinary field, the wave equation, where you can specify an arbitrary distribution on a line and a rate of change of that arbitrary distribution, and then you've got the wave equation going. You can't do anything in general relativity, and you've got, until you've got initial data that satisfy the constraints. And in the Hamiltonian formulation, the free metric, the Gij, has a canonical conjugate momentum, Pij. And there are two constraints which you have to satisfy. One of them is that this Pij with respect to the Gij has a vanishing divergence. That's the momentum constraint. And that is actually a direct consequence. You will find in most books on general relativity that this is just a reflection of the fact that the coordinates on the surface mean nothing. That's completely wrong. It's a reflection of the best matching. It's that is directly the reflection of the best matching. So this is, and they say that there's no dynamical information in that statement. I don't think that's true. This is the statement of what kind of theory general relativity is. Then there's a quadratic constraint, and I can't remember how to write it down. It goes something like, I probably get it wrong. The quadratic constraint is Pij minus a half P squared, where P is Gij, it's the trace, Pij, minus something like square root of chi, and the three-dimensional scalar curvature equals zero. That's the Hamiltonian constraint, the quadratic constraint. And for a long, long time, people didn't realize how incredibly important it was to be able to find initial data that satisfied these constraints. This was a fundamental feature of general relativity which took a very long time for people to realize. But when people like John Wheeler and Dirac and Arnavid Deza and Misner started to try and quantize general relativity, they came up against this thing and realized how fundamental it was. And John Wheeler got Jimmy York to work on this problem, and I can't remember exactly how it went, But certainly York and Wheeler talking together suggested that he should try some conformal tricks which Lichnerowicz had used 20 years earlier to try and solve this problem. And what it boiled down to in the end, and I'll just sort of... So York did find a method, and it's absolutely vital because the whole of numerical relativity in one form or another relies on the method that York found, certain modifications of it. But it's... using general relativity as a dynamical theory now has only been made possible by this method of finding initial data. And I'm told by Neil that the relativists sort of spend the morning, the first day, getting initial data that they can then evolve. And then after that, it takes them a few weeks to see what black holes will do. But the first step is always to get the initial data. And what is very interesting is that essentially what York does is find the initial data on surfaces of constant mean curvature. Now, surfaces in a space-time, you foliate it in a certain way, and within the space-like hypersurface, you have a three geometry, which is intrinsic to the surface, and you can determine through measurements just done on the surface. And then, as it, so to speak, expands and splays out, the normals to it spread out. And that's measured by another three tensor, the extrinsic curvature, Kij. Kij. And if you take the trace of this thing, Gij, Kij, can't write on the blackboard, is equal to K, that's a constant. And you can choose foliations on which that is constant. And those are called constant mean curvature foliations. And as I learned from Niaj when I was here in the autumn, those are what you get in soap bubbles in three-dimensional space. A soap bubble has quantum mean curvature. And because they are extremal, they're very interesting. So there's lots of very good mathematics associated with it. It's a bit like my perfect thing here. Whenever you get anything which is extremal and perfect, there's interesting and good mathematics associated with it. What York did was to find solutions which turn out to be on these quantum mean curvature foliations. Now, York didn't give any really, and I spent 6 weeks with York in 1992, and he was, first of all, a wonderfully encouraging person, and secondly, he gave me the fantastic tip. He said, I tell you who you need to work with, that's Neil, best student I ever had. And finally, I did manage to get Neil interested in the thing. But I had a lot of discussions with York about sort of philosophy of these things. And York said, look, my father was an engineer and I'm an engineer in spirit. I just look at the equations, and if they work well, then I think nature will think that's right or something like that. And he certainly, what he got at the end, he regarded as the physical metric, he thought, and that was the real thing, and that the whole of space-time was there, and he didn't have any sort of background thing to it. But now let's just... And then he thought you propagate forward in any way you like. He didn't think there would be any fundamental significance in propagating forward in constant mean curvature foliation. Let me say one other thing. There is a thing, you can propagate forward in constant mean curvature foliation by using the Latz fixing equation, which I won't write down. But there are three equations that go into the York method. They're all elliptical equations, and they all have very good uniqueness and existence properties. First of all, you get a transverse traceless tensor. Then you put it into the Lishnerovich-York equation, and then you put it into the Latz. You put the solution into the Latz fixing equation, and then you generate a space-time in constant mean curvature foliation. That's not what the relativists do because they're interested in a slightly different question. But in principle, you could do it, and you can certainly go on for a certain distance, and you can generate infinitely many of these things. And it's happening literally every day with the numerical relativists in a slightly modified form, not for a closed space. Now, what has actually happened? It is absolutely amazing, because the initial data that York puts in is actually purely conformal. There is no angle or anything in it, there's no distance in it at all. What he puts in, and this comes out in the paper which Neil and I, in some form or other, will get posted, but several people here have seen it already, the only data that goes in is a point in conformal superspace and a tangent vector in conformal superspace. And what comes out is a space-time. Now, you started with no time. There was no time, no distance, no local inertial frame of reference, and no definition of simultaneity. And the solution of the Lishnerovich-York equation, the solution of this procedure, and its propagation forward in conformal superspace, in CMC foliation, gives you everything. You suddenly have the distances, what we call the physical distances, is well-defined. Local proper time is well-defined. The local inertial frames of reference are well-defined. And there is a distinguished definition of simultaneity. And that has all come out from angles.
So I think related to what I was just wondering about. So K is an extrinsic curvature, which only makes sense if you have an embedding manifold. You have a four-dimensional space-time. And so the idea is that you're reinterpreting K as, it's the same problem with the velocity if you only have, you don't have an external time. So you're reinterpreting K as something that lives on or in the free manifold.
I should say a little bit more. For the sake of getting somewhere to the end, let's expand things a little bit. Yeah. Now, the way we're presenting it at the moment in the unposted paper is the following. We start off, the key idea is that there's a big difference. The most fundamental thing in a dynamical theory is, what do I need to specify to get a solution, to get an evolution? A second thing is, how do I actually do it? Now, the way I think about it at the moment is that the Einstein field equations are like a computer algorithm. You start off with just transverse traceless. You have this purely conformal data, which is literally purely conformal. And then you put it into a program, and part of, in the program, One step in it is that you specify a numerical value of k. Then you use the Einstein evolution equations to generate the space-time. Now, for the same conformal initial data, if you take different values of k, you get a one-parameter family of Einsteinian space-times, vacuum space-times, but there's an arbitrary definition of some dimensional quantity in it. Your algorithm, you can't produce it without putting one-dimensional quantity into the algorithm, but effectively you could set k equal to 1 or minus 1, and you just get the same result. So, in fact, it's rather interesting. I think what this is saying is that the true degrees of freedom in general relativity are too infinity, speaking, you know, vaguely, to specify the point, and exactly to infinity to specify the velocity. This is Dirac's Darling transformation theory as possible. So before we did this work, and before I came to Perimeter in the autumn, certainly Neil and I and the group I was working with thought that this was actually something dynamical. There's a very suggestive remark of York where he says the picture that emerges is the local degrees of shape interacting with the longitudinal scale, or the rate of change of the scale. And that suggested, I'm pretty certain, to York, and there's a following sentence which seems to suggest that he thought that this was definitely a dynamical degree of freedom like the other ones. So that would mean that the dynamical degrees of freedom of general relativity were 4 infinity plus 1. And Neil and I certainly thought that, and I think that was the general view in the thing. And provided there's not some flaw in Neil's and my argument now, it is actually not that rather ugly one there, but a rather beautiful even number of there. So Dirac in his heaven should, I hope, be pleased with this. And this is it's this fact that it's a tangent vector, by the way, that makes the expansion of the universe possible. Because the independent variable is actually not the expansion of the universe, but it's the ratio of... So what you get, ultimately, I think that independent variable is something which is measuring ratios of volumes. So you start your evolution here, and you nominally give it some volume. Up here, you give it another volume. It generates a volume up here. But what's really determining the curve in conformal superspace is the ratio of those two things. So that's what gets rid of that one there. And Neil certainly was clear about it, and so was I. We just didn't think about that. And that's the mistake that's in the CS+V paper. We didn't realize that we had to get rid of that one dimensional, just one number, which has got dimensions in it. You have to take that out. Let me now just conjecture two things. For years, have been trying to show that the universe doesn't expand, but only changes its shape. Because that seemed to me strange. Now I've come to feel, you know, there comes a point where you say, no, I can't beat all this fabulous explanation that comes from the expansion of the... the interpretation in cosmology. We tried it with the theory without expansion, and it wouldn't work. But that expansion is not a dynamical degree of freedom. It's the independent variable. The shapes are interacting with each other. You don't say that particles interact in Newtonian mechanics. You don't say the particles interact with time. They interact with each other. But time is the independent variable. So it's something, in a first approximation, it's the redshift, which is the independent variable. But that's only the first approximation that's the independent variable. Just about coming to the end. So my conjecture now is that really there is a fundamental quantum mechanics of the entire universe in which there is a perfect transformation theory. And that is what forces the universe to expand. It's a very deep property of the quantum mechanics. And now, while Niash, I'll finish with this, and this is a really, perhaps a pretty wild conjecture. The really miraculous thing is that Lichnerowicz-York equation. I haven't written it down. You start without any way of saying what distance is between objects. But the distances are what we measure with our instruments now and how we interpret the theory. And it's only the shape of the universe which goes into it and the way in which the universe is changing. So the shape and the direction in which the shape is changing suddenly puts all those distances in there. Now, here's my conjecture, which is suggested by your thing. When black holes form, they're changing the shape of the universe. Could it be that they're forcing the universe to get bigger than you expect when you solve the Lichnerowicz-York equation? Let me say, I totally and utterly disbelieve in Friedman, Robertson, Walker. It's a point. It's that point in conformal superspace. There's no change in it. I mean, it's complete fiction, Friedman, Robertson, Walker. Could it be? It's a wild idea. But this would be a very deep explanation within general relativity. If it's the case that the way that it surely is, the shape is changing when black holes form, that the change in the shape is reflected in the solution of the Lichnerowicz-York equation, and that is what is the secret of dark energy. Maybe completely wrong. It just occurred to me while you were giving the talk. But I think it is extremely suggestive, your coincidence, that it seems to be precisely at the stage where the universe is becoming richly structured and something very dramatic is happening in what we call small regions. So I'll stop at that point.
Yeah, just a point of clarification. The thing you didn't say, but I presume is true, is that the space-time that you get is a solution of Einstein's equations foliated with constant mean curvature foliations.
Yes. How far it goes, these are open issues. But, I mean, if I'm inclined to believe that the universe is completely quantum mechanical, and that's all that counts. We don't need to worry about how far we can propagate classical solutions. That's all I wanted to say. I didn't want to give you a stomach ache, Lee.
No, but just the mathematical statement is that the Einstein equations have a reformulation in terms of your principles, which yields solutions of the space times, which are solutions of the Einstein equations, in a given foliation.
They certainly generate a patch. That's absolutely secure because it only relies upon three very good elliptic...
Just
locally, yes.
Okay.
This is just a further clarification. So are these solutions conformal and flat?
No.
No, okay.
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
No, definitely not. No, there's rich structure in there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now about this conjecture, so the problem is, I certainly believe that at the fundamental level that black holes are distinct, that black holes could have something to do with acceleration. But I don't think that can be realized in general relativity because, we understand general relativity very well. One of its features is Birkhoff's theorem that when you have collapsing spherical solutions from outside, nothing changes. So then having a black hole or having a star doesn't make any difference. As long as you stick to general relativity.
We don't. I mean, there's various comments. I'm not sure how much is really known about black holes in a closed space-time. I mean, in a spatially closed universe. It's certainly not spherically symmetric. I think there is scope for... I mean, I don't want to push this thing. I mean, I'm recorded and I'm... People all over the world can see that I've made a fool of myself. But, so I'll put that caveat in. But I'm used to making a fool of myself. So,
the thing is, this has been a very hot debate in cosmology for the past 10 years, that whether formation of structures in general would they affect application of Friedman equation. And, well, since Einstein gravity is a nonlinear theory, then you expect... You expect there to be second order effects that affect cosmic expansion as a result of formation of structures. Now, the thing is that any honest calculation of these effects show that these effects are small.
Yes, could I now make the point that they start from Friedman Robert Walker as the first approximation?
That's
if
true.
That is rotten to the core,
yeah.
That's a different game.
That's right, but then you need a different start.
Oh, yeah. Yes, no. It's not going to be easy to check this. I mean, maybe I shall live without being made a fool of until I'm dead. So, truly dead.
I have two loosely connected questions. So, the first question is, in a world in which geometry performs the role that you say it does, it's clear that there can be variety.
Yeah.
But how can there be change and causation? And my second question is this. Much of what you said seems equally consistent with the idea that there is no time and with the idea that there is global time, although not with the idea that time is only local. How does one choose between these two views, and what are the consequences of the choice?
No, I haven't been sleeping very well. sorry. The first question, could you repeat the first question, Roberto?
So the first question
is... Do one at a time, if you would.
Yes, okay. So the first question is, if geometry performs the role that you say it does,
yes,
it's clear that there can be variety.
Yes.
But it's not clear that there can be change and causation.
Yeah, very good. There is variety, and it's unfortunate that I use the word change. I should use the word difference. And now my feeling about causality is that causality does not work from some past to the future, but it works in some way that quantum mechanics is just entirely defined upon this space here and bears no relation to time at all. And the point that I wanted, which I emphasize in making it, this is a hugely asymmetrical space. There's a huge asymmetry in our existence between the past and the future in our psychological, the way we talk about it. Einstein very correctly says, invoking Leibniz's principle of sufficient reason, a manifest effect must have a genuine cause. And my belief is that the ultimate explanation of the arrow of time is in the asymmetry of the configuration space. I conjecture this in my book, The End of Time, on the basis of the assumption that the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is the right description of quantum gravity. I'm now beginning to question that because of this result here that the tangent vector is there. But nevertheless, I think it is still very suggestive. Now, I would say that the causation is not from past to present and on into the future, but is, so to speak, horizontal across the thing here. The quantum mechanics, just in my view, knows only about this thing here. And if it has a propensity to select configurations which, as I use the expression, reek of the past, that's what I call a time capsule. And that's exactly where we find ourselves. Everywhere we look, we find time capsules. All of your faces are familiar to me now, and I guess I'm familiar to you too. These are all things that we interpret as records. And we interpret it, at the moment, as being something happened in the past, a very special initial condition in the past. There were laws of classical and quantum mechanics which somehow got us to where we are now. The initial condition was low entropy, so there can be records around us now. There might be a totally different explanation of this, which doesn't involve that sort of causality at all, but does involve explanation in the Greek sense, just as there is an explanation for this structure here, which has nothing whatever to do with time, and is purely in very Leibnizian, fundamental Leibnizian terms. So I think there's definitely a possibility that the explanation for us finding ourselves here in this incredibly richly structured, delightful place, Waterloo, well, the park is very beautiful, and the company is absolutely excellent. Maybe this has a deep explanation in quantum mechanical terms due to the structure of the interaction between the law and the thing on which it operates. Second question, if that was adequately answered.
The second question is that much of what you said seems to be consistent either with the idea of that there is no time or with the idea that there's global time as opposed to just local time. And I want to understand how you come to choose and on what basis you choose between these two interpretations of your geometrical view, and what are the implications?
Well, I define an instant of time as a configuration, and I stick with that. And that's a global notion. There is certainly no, I can't see any way that there's going to be a unique history coming out of this unless there's some radical change to quantum mechanics, which may well happen, of course. But if quantum mechanics goes on all the way out on the configuration space, I don't see that happening. So there are just these time capsules, as I call them, scattered around here. They're very thinly, very hard to find them if you just looked at it from outside. So if my conjecture is right, it's a wonderful feature of quantum mechanics. Unlike classical mechanics, where every statistical argument suggests that something dull will be experienced, my conjecture is that quantum mechanics actually predicts that the probability is on interesting things. That semantics, that in fact there's an intimate connection between the probability that quantum mechanics makes and semantic content. That's got semantic content, and it's produced by a law. And so we've got semantic content, very rich.
May I try to rephrase what I think Roberto is asking? From my perspective over here, it almost feels as if you receive a bit of religious comfort in saying that there is no time, that there is no such thing as time. And I hear that in my right ear, because in my left ear, I hear you say there's this configuration and this other configuration, and we are right here, and maybe later.
Oh.
We shall not say later. We are here. We are here. We are. Sounds a bit like Horton Hears a Who. We are here. We are here. We are here. That looks like time to me, but you don't want to say it's time.
I don't want to say it's time.
So
no.
Why do you resist saying it's time? That's not clear to me. So the
why, well, it's not.
And
it's not. It's not.
Where is
it's not linear time. It's not linear time, as I think most people think of linear time. And Lee certainly said it explicitly. Can I just say on the religious questions? I'm an agnostic. I would, if anything, I would be with Spinoza. God is nature, and nature is God. I mean, we're one and the same, and we are part of nature. So we're, if you like, we are divine in that sense. And frankly, I just enjoy life, so I'm not too worried about other things. And try not to be nasty to people if I can avoid it, things like that.
Well, actually, I didn't mean to be nasty.
No, you weren't. No, I wasn't. I wasn't worried to blind.
But it seems like you get some comfort in not saying the word time. You get it looks like a kind of an arbitrary distinction at this point, which I think was the essence of Roberto's question. You could say you have global time, or you could say no time at all.
My comfort comes from enjoying the world. I'm looking forward to lunch and the company. I enjoy the company. I mean, that's enough. And by the way, can I just come in at this thing? There's a rather interesting thing here which I forgot. May I just don't do that and then I come back in. Leibniz's theodicy. Leibniz has a theory or said that there's an explanation why there's evil in the world. And he said that the best of all possible worlds can't be created without a certain amount of evil in it, but the good outweighs the evil. Now, this is rather interesting, because if variety is what you like, uniformity is evil. So variety is good, and uniformity is evil. And all of these structures, they always come out to create the maximal variety. They always have to have a long stretch of uniformity. So this is, in some sense, maybe a theory of good and evil in that sort of sense.
Let's let Roberto follow up first.
I just have a comment on what you said, because it has to do with a recurring theme in our discussions here. So one interpretation of Julian's argument is that he says, if you credit mathematics in general and geometry in particular with these extraordinary revelatory powers, you are driven to the view that time is not real in the way in which we ordinarily think it is. And I take it that the established view wants to have it both ways, and wants to say that mathematics does have these revelatory powers, but nevertheless to resist Julian's conclusions about time. And that's to me, one of the most interesting recurrent problems in our conversations.
Yeah, I think it's a fair statement. I mean, I'm happy to let go of time. I did it about 40 years ago. So. There's a kind of paradox problem. It was over here. That's true.
Kevin's been chomping it up.
Yeah,
so I wanted to say something about time as well, because this is a theme that, appears in, my presentation yesterday on special relativity and, Philip's work on quantum mechanics and, Ariel's as well. Ariel talks about change, and when we talk about order, you know, whether we have an ordering relation, be it information or, influence, whatever, that doesn't matter. There's an ordering relation, which is what you're saying here. And, that's what's what Philip was presenting with quantum mechanics. There's an order in which measurements are performed. And, order is fundamental. And, time comes about, the more general concept of time endowed with a measure comes about later, it seems.
I would say that the measure, the experiment, the outcome is your comparison of your record of the procedure that you set up with what you observe. That's the epistemological starting point. How you interpret it is another matter. And I would go for a radically different interpretation from the one that most people give.
Steve, you have a question?
This is sort of a comment on this exchange here. I thought that your point about time has to do with more, getting rid of time has to do with getting rid of, it's the same, motivated by getting rid of space. It's nothing particular about geometry, it's an epistemic point.
It's getting rid of uniformity, featurelessness.
Right, but this is all driven by the idea that you can't, you don't want to promote the physical reality quantities that you can't observe. This is where your point about.
Yeah, I want there to be no gap between theory and epistemology.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
I think part of at the risk of trying to channel Paul, part of the issue is that there's multiple arrows in time that are all very deeply ingrained in our intuition. And the way that I interpret, channel, agree with Julian, is that the psychological arrow, which drives, posit a lot of the kind of thinking of Roberto and Lee, the question becomes, can that, to what degree can that be explicated in full in terms of other physical phenomena, so that every instance, quote unquote, is co-equal, co-real, that you are at any particular instant, when your memories of the past are just retrodictions a priori, no more reliable and true than predictions. That's you by definition, it's almost a tautology. I cannot go back to the past as it really was, and never do mind time machines. I'm just, consciousness is an instant.
Yeah.
Consciousness is a singleton. And no singleton can truly know. I cannot know that I am a brain in a vat that exists for a single instant and that there was never anything else. All I can do is make inferences, retrodictions, predictions concerning the structure that is there. And that, I think, is one of the very, very, compared to the mountains that Julian is scaling, that's one of the only line of foothills, but I think there's a crucial point to, that's why how the epistemological issues come in. You don't know the past, you can't, tautologically, any more than you can know the future, or know what's the other side that won't. You can only make inference. You are a singleton. And all of yous across all of what you think might be are all themselves singletons.
Yeah. Yeah. Very clear.
So, I just wanted to make a comment about this religious point of view of whether there's time or not. I wanted to say, like, the opposite is sounds to me more religious, at least in the scientific, in the physics community, that for the past 100 years, everybody in the past 90 years really seemed to believe that gravity is a theory of geometry of space-time, and where space and time are put in the same footing. And that is a very, I think, dogmatic point of view that has been very successful, and but I was talking about maybe not far from here on. And I think what's remarkable about what Julian is saying is that he's questioning that dogmatic point of view that the space and time are always in the same footing. And I don't know, you may disagree with me, but at least from a pragmatic point of view, from my point of view, that opens up
lots of possibilities that could give us many new theories. And Julian, you study general relativity in this context. But I mean, what's interesting for us as theoretical physicists is that it opens up all these new windows that we can play with, where space and time are not necessarily the same footing. You may call it time, or you may not call it time. It's just that you have new windows of opportunity, and you can make new predictions. And I think that's remarkable.
Mm. I mean, that's quite true. I mean, 40 years ago, I wrote a paper, which appeared in a Polish journal, saying it was all about the conflict between Mach and Minkowski. I mean, I've hardly mentioned Mach, but which one was going to win? Could I just make a comment? I think it's possible your worry about violation of special relativity, Lee, not showing up as yet. I think this thing may actually, in some senses, leave Lorentz invariance perfectly intact all the way down, and yet somehow be profoundly important for the overall structure of what we experience, because there's no sign of any change to it in this thing. The other thing I want to say is that for centuries people have said that there are three obvious relativities: the relativity of position, the relativity of size, and the relativity of, if you doubled all the speeds in the universe, nothing would change. But Einstein brought in a totally unexpected thing, that time and space were relative to the way you cut that thing. That was a completely unexpected thing, which wasn't deep in our psyche. But if you try and do, I think conceptually this could have been developed before special relativity was discovered. I mean, we know Clifford in 1870 conjectured that matter and motion was nothing but curvature of geometry moving relative to each other. If Clifford and Mach had got together a few years later and had tried to do a theory in conformal superspace, I think it's entirely possible they could have discovered general relativity. Sean and I have been looking for a word to describe the combination of the three-dimensional diffeomorphism group and the three-dimensional conformal group, and we've come up with, I've been conjecturing something like the geometry group, because it is actually exactly what you need, those two things combined. If you boil down geometry to its irreducible core, you get conformal superspace. So it's extremely natural to seek a dynamical theory of such geometry coming from Clifford's point of view, without perhaps a historical accident of special relativity being discovered in the way it was.
I think we should thank Julian again for that. Everyone who's going to try some more questions.
Since we're running a little late,